There's a holdup in the Bronx, Brooklyn's broken out in fights. There's a traffic jam in Harlem that's backed up to Jackson Heights. There's a scout troop short a child, Khrushchev's to an Idlewild. Car 54, where are you?
Shalom, welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and while this show is officially for Shabbat Parshat Tetzaveh, Shabbat Zachor, it is also the pre-Purim show, hence the choice of a different theme opener, and we will have a mixture of what's called regular Torah Tidbits Audio and some Purim fun throughout the show.
There's a holdup in the Bronx, Brooklyn's broken out in fights. There's a traffic jam in Harlem that's backed up to Jackson Heights. There's a scout troop short a child, Khrushchev's to an Idlewild. Car 54, where are you?
In order for you to know what that was, you have to be of a certain age and have to have been in a certain place in a certain time with a certain disposition to know that that was the theme song of a show called Car 54, Where Are You? For those who do know what it was and have fond memories of it, and you would like to tell your children about it or something like that, for some of you, you'll have to explain what Bronx and Brooklyn mean. For others, you'll have to tell who Khrushchev was and what Idlewild was. So those become the more trivia part of the question. But I chose that theme song to start this sort of pre-Purim show. As I said in the voiceover, if it came out clear enough, I will mix regular Torah Tidbits audio kind of material with some Purim fun, and I hope that people will at least be able to tell one from the other. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shimavikoli Tihiena Aznecha Kashuvot Lekol Tachanunai. Imavonot Tishmarya Adonai Miya Amod. Ki Imacha Haslicha Lema'an Tivarei. Kiviti Adonai Kiveta Nafshi Velidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi Ladonai, Mishomerim Laboker, Shomerim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai, Kim Adonai HaChesed, Vaharbeimo Fedut. Vehu Yifde et Yisrael, Mikol Avonotav. Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael, Hanatunim Batsarao Vashivya, Haomedim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha. Hamakom Yirachem Aleihem, Viyotziyem, Mitzaral Yirvacha, Umeyafela Laora, Umishibud Lagula, Hashta Ba'agala Uvizman Kariv, Vinomar Amen. Now the Achenu that we just said is so appropriate for Purim, and it reminds one of some of the content of the Megillah. When you have, first, that we ask God to have mercy on our brethren wherever they be, and to take them from tzara to revacha, and from afela leora, from times of trouble and pain, to a comfortable existence, from darkness to light, mishibud legeula, from oppression and slavery to redemption. That is exactly what the Megillah is about. We speak of the day of Purim, and we speak of the month of Adar, of a day that reversed, turnabout, v'nahafochu, from just those kind of dark things to the light things. So the prayer, which we use generically, we'll say, every show, is particularly reminiscent of Purim. Let me get serious before I get whatever the opposite of serious is. And it's something that has been percolating in my mind for a long time. And I've said, spoken about it and written about it in different ways. And I have yet another way to present it. Let's get some facts on the ground first. These words are first being recorded on Thursday, March 9th, the 9th of Adar, in the year 5766. We're approaching this Shabbat, where the Parshat HaShavua, the weekly Torah reading, is Tetzaveh, and the special reading for this Shabbat is called Zachor, to remember Amalek. The Torah commands us to remember what Amalek did to the Jewish people when they left Egypt. For those who are not up on this, we're talking about the biblical account of the first encounter between Amalek and Israel. I would put an asterisk there on the word first, because it really is the, well, we'll say it's not really the first, but the first of the nation Amalek against the nation, or the soon-to-be nation of Israel. The way the Torah describes it, Vayizanev becha kol hanechashalim acharecha, they attacked the weak stragglers to the proceeding camp, and that immediately creates an image of cowardly attack. Yehoshua was told by Moshe to gather an army and fight against Amalek, and the Torah says that Amalek was weakened, not destroyed or vanquished, weakened via chalosh Yehoshua at Amalek bechorev, something like that, by the sword. And the Torah's commandment, mitzvah, to remember Amalek, is defined by our sages as the public reading of Parshat Zachor, which is found in the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy, at the end of Parshat Ki Tetzeh. The sages furthermore chose the Shabbat before Purim to be the Shabbat on which we read Parshat Zachor. The implication is that the Torah did not pinpoint a specific time to do this, but our sages, Chazal, said best time, the Shabbat before Purim. And the standard reason, of course, is that Haman, the villain of the Purim story, was a descendant of Amalek, and therefore we bring the two together to remind us of that. But there's more. Let's go back a little to who Amalek the person was before we talk about the nation that he spawned. Amalek was a grandson of Esav, brother, twin of Yaakov Avinu, and his sworn enemy. There's a midrash that says that when Esav realized he could not vanquish Yaakov, he called his grandson and said, "You have to do the job for me." When the Torah speaks of Milchama Lashem ba'Amalek, a perennial battle of God with Amalek, Midor Dor, from generation to generation, then of course we see the corollary to Haman being a descendant of Amalek, as Haman's plot and threat to the Jewish people as a continuation of this perennial battle between God and Amalek, between the Jewish people and Amalek, Amalek and the Jewish people, etc. And putting it slightly differently, the way I saw it in a book called Adar and Purim by Harav Yoel Schwartz, he writes there that it was not merely descendants of Amalek put next to the command to remember Amalek, but in the time of Mordechai and Esther, the command to destroy Amalek was fulfilled with the killing of Haman and his 10 sons. And therefore what the sages did was juxtapose the mitzvah to destroy Amalek with a fulfillment of that mitzvah in the Purim story. Be that as it may, which somehow I like to say every so often, mostly when it's appropriate, be that as it may, I just feel that there's another point in this connection. Remember that Amalek attacked Israel, let's say, as the legacy of Esav and his hatred for Yaakov, and that we did our best at the time with Yehoshua in the field and Moshe, Aharon, and Hur on the hilltop, adding their prayer and petition to God to the fighting force commanded by Yehoshua. And what was accomplished was Vayachalosh. Yehoshua made Amalek weaker and his nation by the sword. Of course, had that battle been totally successful, then there wouldn't be a connection with Purim and Amalek if there would have been a Purim. But the point is that by the nature of Amalek's role, let's say, in Jewish history, we have the Torah's statement that this is going to be midor dor, from generation to generation. And therefore, whatever successes there are only partial. Amalek does its damage. And whether we are talking about a genealogical descendant of Amalek or a spiritual heir of Amalek is not relevant, because we could look to the recent past and Hitler and the Nazis and their final solution, where they too, like Haman, their ancestor, at least in spirit, who wanted to destroy every man, woman, and child in the nation of Mordechai. That's what the final solution was meant to be. And they did not succeed, but they certainly chalked up a terrible, devastating body count. So, with that background, we celebrate Purim. And here's my point, and I don't know if I'm getting to it in the right way. Purim, as a victory over Haman, as a salvation for the Jewish people, is, at best, a temporary milestone in the favorable outcome department in this perennial battle. It is by no means the celebration of the total fulfillment of Timche et Zecher Amalek Mitachar HaShemayim, and yet we have this celebration. In other words, in a long, drawn-out, protracted war, a victory in battle can be celebrated without anyone saying, well, remember 2 weeks ago what happened, and remember what might happen, or think about what might happen 2 weeks from now. Furthermore, the Jews at the time of the Purim story were towards the end of the 70 years of exile following the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. The aftermath of the Purim story, the Jews were still in exile, and their return to Zion was not in numbers and percentages that we could really be proud of, but we still celebrate Purim. It's a very similar thought to the ones that I've always had about Chanukah, and I say that in light of more modern days of celebration in the modern state of Israel to Jews of, let's call them us, the religious Zionist bent, was the establishment of the State of Israel, its declaration of independence on Hey Iyar 5708, May 14th, 1948. Was that the final, happy, live happily ever after resolution of a long, long period of exile and strife? No, it wasn't. Was Purim the end of the grief? No, it wasn't. And Hanukkah wasn't either. And Pesach, being just at the beginning, certainly had an awful lot of stuff in front of it. So none of that was, and we lived happily ever after, and yet they are celebrations. And I've always been a champion of thanking God and celebrating the establishment of the State of Israel, or the reunification of Jerusalem with Yom Yerushalayim, even though we still find ourselves in less than ideal circumstances. We can even argue that we are in a better position today than the Jews of the Persian Empire were following the Purim story. But the point is, we celebrate Purim, we celebrate Hanukkah, we should be celebrating, and many of us are, Yom HaAtzma'ut and Yom Yerushalayim. Yes, in spite of current events. Yes, in spite of an awful lot of things. I would like to suggest that that's a message of Purim. Last week we played a couple of tracks from an album by Noam Productions called Greatest Purim Hits with Avrami Flam. I'd like to play another track from there now. The song is called Machot Timche. Most of the words come from Parshat Zachor, kind of an unusual song. You don't usually find a song about remembering Amalek within a medley of Purim songs, but of course that's where it belongs. So if such a song were to exist, which obviously it does, we would find it there. After the song, I would like to talk a little bit more about the mitzvah of Zachor, and apologizing in advance to listeners who know the basics, I would assume there are a lot of listeners who don't. I will say also honestly that with a mixed audience of listenership, which includes religious, practicing, observant, knowledgeable Jews, as well as non-observant and perhaps not knowledgeable of Jewish tradition, plus non-Jews of various levels of background, and not knowing exactly who's listening, it's difficult to touch upon these topics, but I will, and any listener comments are welcome by writing to me at TTA, Torah Tidbits Audio, TTA, at IsraelNationalRadio.com. But anyway, hear the song first, based on Parshat Zachor.
Amalek.
Okay, down to basics. What is called Parshat Zachor, the portion of the Torah, quote, remember, is referring to three verses at the end of Parshat Ki Tetzé. As I mentioned earlier, they are in Deuteronomy chapter 25, 17 through 19. Those three verses contain three different commands. A positive mitzvah to remember what Amalek did on our way out of Egypt, to destroy Amalek, and a prohibition never to forget Amalek. Parshat Zohar, by the way, at least in the Ashkenazi kind of reading, sounds like this. Zachor eis asher osolecha Amalek baderech betzeisechem mimitzrayim asher korecha baderech vayzanev becha kol hanecheshalim acharecha viata oyef viyageya v'lo yarei Elohim v'haya b'haniach Adonai Elohecha lecha mikol oyevecha misaviv ba'aretz asher Adonai Elohecha nosein lecha nachala lirishta timche es zecher Amalek mitachas hashamayim lo tishkach. Amalek, for the Jewish people, is not just a nation. It represents a type of non-Jew and his hatred towards the Jewish people, mostly, but maybe not exclusively, of the just because we are here kind of attitude. Not with a bone to pick. We, the Jewish people, certainly have suffered through many, many episodes of battles with Amalek. Just go back to that original battle of the guardian angel of Esav against Yaakov Avinu, and you could see it there in a nutshell. Yaakov survived his battle, but he walked away limping. We, throughout the generations, survive battles and oppression and persecution, but we too walk away limping. I wouldn't exactly call this a Purim message, but it's certainly a Zachor message, and it's related to Purim, and that's why we have to say it now also.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a faithful trip that started from this tropic point aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, skipper brave and sure. Five passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour, a 3-hour tour. The weather started getting rough, the tiny ship was tossed. If not for the courage of a fearless crew, the middle would be lost. The middle would be lost. The ship set ground on the shore of this uncharted desert isle, with Gilligan, the skipper too. A millionaire and his wife, a movie star, the professor and Mary Ann, here on Gilligan. This is the tale of our castaways, they're here for a long, long time. They've had to make the best of things, it's an uphill climb. But first mate and his skipper too will do their very best to make the others comfortable in a tropic island nest.
No boat, no light,
no motor car, not a single luxury. Like Robinson Crusoe, it's primitive as can be. So join us here each week, my friends, you're sure to get a smile from seven stranded castaways here on Gilligan's Isle.
Starting our second half of this week's Torah Tidbits audio, we had the theme from Gilligan's Island. I would say that does not go back as far as Car 54, Where Are You? It took me all of this time to think of a relevance of Car 54, Where Are You? Theme to being a pre-Purim show, and I found it. And that is simply, there are 54 occurrences of the name Haman in Megillah. That's an important number to remember. More important than the fact that there are about 58 Mordechais and 55 Esthers. And I have always found that the number of occurrences of those names being roughly in the same ballpark are interesting. You could even fake the numbers to fit better. If there are 58 Mordechais and you take 54 Hamans and you add 4 times Zeresh, Haman's wife, then they total 58. And the gematria 58 is the name Noach, and what the connection is, I don't know, but you could have a little fun with Purim. But getting back to the numbers, I would say the name which is most important to know how many there are is Haman's name, because we make noise when Haman's name is read. And I think a kid would like to know that he's got 54 chances to make a pain in the neck of himself in shul. And if he wants to count, let him count. Speaking of making noise for Haman's name, there are some communities which don't allow it in every chapter. And some allow it only when his name is said full, as Haman ben Hamdata Ha'agagi Tzorer HaYehudim. And that cuts down on the noise in shul. But the standard place that allows noise for all of the Hamans, car 54, where are you? There are 54 occurrences of the name Haman in Megillat Esther. How about that? Now I've got a little time to figure out the relevance of Gilligan's Island. Let me spend a little time talking about Tetzaveh. Tetzaveh is, in one way, a continuation of Terumah, because you have another major aspect of the fashioning of the sanctuary to God, mentions the use of olive oil for the menorah, and then gets into the issue of the special garments of the Kohen in general, and the Kohen Gadol in particular. Then the Sedra gets back to the Mizbeach HaZahav, the one major furnishing in the sanctuary, which surprisingly was not mentioned in Parshat Terumah. And you have a description also of the 7-day period of inauguration of the Mishkan and the various things that were required thereof. One of the famous trivia facts about Tetzaveh is that Moshe's name is conspicuously missing. You do not have, as you do in most of the Sedras, from the beginning of Shemot through Bamidbar at least, you do not have the typical, and God spoke to Moshe saying, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lemor. In fact, you would expect it right up front in this Parsha, and that's why it is noted that his name is missing. It begins right away with Viata Tetzaveh, and now you shall also command the taking of the olive oil, and Moshe's name is not there. I would say the more popular reason for the absence of Moshe's name, which happens to coincide or be very near the date we attribute to Moshe's birth and death, namely the 7th of Adar, today be the 9th, so that was 2 days ago, is that Moshe Rabbeinu said to God in anger, or in angry response to God's threat to destroy the Jewish people following the sin of the golden calf. Moshe says to God, if you're going to destroy the people, then mecheni mi sifracha asher katavta, erase me also from the book which you wrote. God says to Moshe, on one level, I won't destroy the people. On another level, says to Moshe, you gotta watch what you say. You don't say things to God like, wipe me out of your book, because God has the power to do it. As a token admonition, chastisement, reprimand, or whatever you want to call it, Moshe's name was erased, so to speak, from Parsha Tetzaveh, the Parsha of his birth and death. So, or another way of looking at it is, he said to God, erase me from the book which you wrote, if that's what you're going to do. And that happens in next week's reading of Ki Tisa. And therefore, it's as if God reluctantly removed his name at the last possible instant, meaning going around the full cycle of the reading of the Torah, didn't want to do it right away in Ki Tisa, didn't want to do it in the next week, nor the next, at least this is one way that you could look at it. So the last opportunity to give that token reproach, I think that was the word I was looking for in the first place, is to make the name absent from Tetzaveh. There's another explanation. I don't remember where I saw it. I don't think I made it up myself. And I think it has appeal because it's sort of a positive reason. Moshe Rabbeinu always outshadows his brother, his older brother, Aharon. Even though repeated references to Moshe and Aharon are supposedly balanced by a few references to Aharon and Moshe in the Torah, and Rashi says that comes to teach us that they are equals, it is clear from other passages that they are far from equal. When God is reprimanding Aharon and Miriam for what Miriam spoke behind Moshe's back, God says to them, Moshe Rabbeinu is different from everybody else. I have a special relationship with him. So that's kind of clear. What it means that they're equal is another issue. In any event, the Sedra that Aharon takes center stage is Parshat Tetzaveh, because it speaks there of making the garments that Aharon was to wear, Lekavod Ulatiferet, for honor and glory. Different explanations as to what that means, but one possibility is that it's referring to the honor and glory of the Kohen Gadol. So Moshe Rabbeinu graciously steps out of the limelight, stands off stage, is referred to only by pronouns, and you shall command, and you shall do this, even though Moshe is definitely a player in Parshat Tetzaveh. His name is not mentioned, and possibly you could also explain that it's because it allows Aharon to take his bows without that shadow of Moshe. Okay, let's switch gears now, and I'd like to share with you I think, one of my favorite pieces of what they call Purim Torah, which just means fooling around a little, but having it sound like it's a serious thing. I don't even know if that describes what I'm about to tell you. The topic is belly buttons, specifically the balance in this world since creation and the appearance of man and woman on the face of this earth down to this very day. The question is, or it all began with, how can you tell the difference between Adam and Eve and everybody else? And the answer to that riddle of old was no belly button. Since they were not born, but they were created, they did not have an umbilical cord to tie off to their biological mothers, since they had no biological mother. And of course, you can ruin the whole thing and say they were created with a belly button like all future human beings, but you gotta be careful not to mix in too many facts and not to take this too seriously. If it is so that Adam and Eve did not have a belly button, then the billions of people who have lived since creation to this very day, if you were to calculate or estimate or just make a statement about the number, the average number of belly buttons per person, it would have to be a tiny, tiny bit less than one. What brings balance back into the world of belly buttons are two people from Megillat Esther, because the famous riddle kind of fooling around question is, how many belly buttons did Vashti have, first queen of Ahasuerus? The answer is, she had two. As the verse testifies, Gam Vashti Hamalka Asita Mishte Nashim. Literally, and Vashti the queen too made a party for women. Beit HaMalchut Asher LaMelech Achashverosh, in the palace of the king. This follows from the description of the elaborate party that Achashverosh threw. So the Megillah is telling us Vashti also made a party. However, you can reread those words, Gam Vashti HaMalka, and also Queen Vashti, Aseta Mishtei Nashim, was made from two women. A person made from two women, a person with two biological mothers, has two umbilical cords that must be cut and tied off, and therefore we have biblical evidence that Vashti had two belly buttons. We also can infer that Achashverosh had two belly buttons as well, since the Megillah says, Gam Vashti HaMalka. Also, Vashti was made from two women, implying that Achashverosh, the antecedent, the one who was described before, was also made Mishtei Nashim, from two women. So if, in fact, both Achashverosh and Vashti had two belly buttons, and if, in fact, Adam and Eve each had none, the average number of belly buttons for every single man, woman, and child in the history of the world is exactly one. This restores a balance that is disturbed by that original riddle of Adam and Eve not having belly buttons. People take this one step further, and they say there is evidence that Vashti had two mothers, which would give Achashverosh two mothers-in-law, which would explain a lot of things. But we have two verses, or two pieces of verses, one that says, Vachamato Ba'aravo, his anger boiled in him, burned in him. This was after what happened with Vashti. But the other way of reading it, on a flippant level, is Vachamato refers to his mother-in-law, her name being Baravo. Later it says, after Haman was hanged, Vachamat HaMelech Shachacha, and the mother-in-law of the king was Shachacha. So with a mother-in-law named Baravo and a mother-in-law named Shachacha, the implication is he had two mothers-in-law. Vashti had two mothers, two belly buttons, Asta Mishtei Nashim, and that's the story. Sometime last year or the year before, we recorded one of our Sherut Lumi girls at the Israel Center doing an imitation of Donald Duck singing Mishanichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha. I hope you are looking forward as much to it as I am. Whether you are or not, here it is. Anyone who chooses to have roast duck for their Purim Seuda this year, or anyone who refuses to have roast duck for their Purim Seuda, will be well understood and excused based on that rendition by Donald Duck. Back to the serious side of Purim. However many things that I have said, would like to say, other people would say, on what I just called the serious side of Purim, it seems that Purim Day is not the time for it. Purim Day is a day of celebration without having to flavor it, compromise it with the heavy issues, and there are. That's the amazing thing. I believe that's why Ta'anit Esther exists. I believe that's what Parshat Zohar is doing the Shabbat before Purim. You can reflect upon these things, speak about them, develop them before Purim, as Purim approaches. When Purim comes, it is a joyous celebration. We have 2 days of Purim, atypical, very much so, of Jewish celebrations. But we have the 14th of Adar, which this year is the 14th of March as well, beginning on the night before, March 13th, Monday night, Megillah reading everywhere outside of Jerusalem, and the 14th is celebrated as Purim with the various mitzvot that are performed on that day in Yerushalayim. We celebrate on Tuesday night with the reading of the Megillah, Wednesday morning another reading of the Megillah, and Mishloach Manot and Matanot Lev Yonim and Seudat Purim and the reciting of Al Hanisim and the special Torah reading are all done on Wednesday, not on Tuesday. But this is based on the Megillah as well. Ironically, Jerusalem was in total ruin and empty of people at the time of the Purim story, and that it should rise to a position of unique prominence in the celebration of Purim is unusual, unless you think about it as it's because Jerusalem was in ruin that we got ourselves into trouble in the first place. In fact, the only other city besides Shushan, the capital of the Persian Empire, of Ahasuerus' kingdom, is mentioned several times in Megillah. Yerushalayim is also mentioned in context of who Mordechai was. He was an Ish Yehudi, a Jew. His name was Mordechai ben Shimi ben Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ish Yemini. And then he's described as Asher Hagla Mirushalayim, he who was exiled from Jerusalem at one of the periods of exile. That right away brings to mind the important emphasis that Purim happened in exile. In fact, it happened during an exile which could have been over because the Jewish people were given permission by the then king of the Persian Empire, to Koresh, Cyrus, to return to the land of Israel and to build the Beit HaMikdash. And a regrettably, pitifully small number of Jews chose to return. So that's part of what inputs into Purim. But again, you could talk about it before Purim, you could talk about it after, although after Purim our focus changes to Pesach, but not on Purim. Keep Purim light, keep Purim happy, and that's the message. What can I say more than Shabbat Shalom and Purim Sameach, and may we be privileged to the Geula Shleima that from the perspective of Purim was only a dream of the future, but recognized as such. But again I say, enjoy each joy on its own. That seems to be the only healthy way to look at things. Lehishtameah.
One of these days.